When we come back, we'll do his ethics and then go on to look at other Enlightenment movements before we finally come to the real crossroads in Western philosophy, Immanuel Kant. All right, yesterday we left Hume and his negative, somewhat agnostic views with respect to religion. He believes that religious differences are only verbal differences, just like you would have verbal differences if you argued over how beautiful Cleopatra was. The thing that Hume especially disliked about religion, as we have noted already in his life, is the ethical perspective, especially of Christianity. We see that that was a problem for him early in life and right down to the time right before he died. He was still objecting to the moral dimension of religion. And so it would be appropriate for us to take a look at Hume's own ethic, his own approach to ethics. And I think the most important thing for you to note is that Hume's approach is empirical. He does not want to approach ethics from a normative or a prescriptive perspective. He doesn't want to discover what men ought to do, but rather he just wants to study what people talk about and how they behave when it comes to moral discourse. Hume wants a descriptive ethic. A descriptive ethic would be similar to a sociologist going to the South Sea Islands and studying the sexual practices or mores of the people on the South Sea Islands. That doesn't commit one to any kind of conclusion that they're right or wrong about their ethical views or practices, just this is what they happen to do. And we'll see in just a moment that the empirical approach to ethics, Hume's descriptive rather than prescriptive ethical analysis, leads to subjectivism on the normative side. Everybody's got their own sentiment, everybody's got their own particular view of what pleases them or is convenient, but it's a subjective matter. There's no universal or absolute right and wrong. So let's notice, first of all, that Hume says morality cannot be grounded in reason. Morality cannot be grounded in reason. We never discover in our impressions, when we're talking about ethics, our ethical discourse never goes back to the source, to an impression or a new fact that has been discovered in the world. And ethics is never a matter of necessary relations being inferred. So for Hume, there is no basis for a demonstrative ethic. Morality is not grounded in reason. Now, this is not to deny that reason plays a role when we are discussing ethics, either internally, kind of deliberating within ourselves, or, you know, when we're in dialogue with each other, or when we're talking about other people's ethical discourse. Reason does play a role, but reason is never the basis for ethics. Reason is always subordinate to sentiment. And so Hume likened moral goodness as a sentiment, if you will. He likened it or compared it to beauty. And you've all heard the expression, I'm sure, beauty is in the eye of the beholder. And this is Hume's approach. Moral goodness is like that. It's in the eye of the beholder. It's a matter of sentiment. When we study ethics, according to Hume, we are not seeking normative conclusions. We are only trying to be empirical and descriptive of what, as a matter of fact, is desired or not desired by men. We don't ask what men ought to do. We simply look at what they happen to do and desire, and we analyze the meaning of their terms, or to put it in a more contemporary way, we do an analysis of their ethical discourse. What do they mean by their terms? And that's the extent of ethical philosophy. What does virtue then become for David Hume? Virtue is what we desire. Virtue is what is agreeable to us, and he thought that he could generalize now, doing his descriptive, observational approach to ethics. He thought he could generalize that what most people desire falls into either the category of pleasure or the category of utility, usefulness, convenience. men desire pleasure and they desire utility. And even though I'm offering only a bare bones outline of his ethic here, I think we can stop it and ask whether Hume lived up to his own project in ethical philosophy. He certainly doesn't live up to Dr. Bahnsen's. I believe ethics is a normative study. I think you should be asking what men ought to do or what they ought not to do and so forth. So I realize that Hume doesn't agree with my Christian approach to ethics, but I just want to ask, has Hume done a good job given his own approach to ethics? According to Hume, we're supposed to just describe what we find out there in the world. And is it true that what men consider virtue, it doesn't have to be the word virtue, any number of ethical terms could be put in its place, but whatever the positive term in our ethical discourse is, that they align that with pleasure or utility? And I maintain that this is really inductively inadequate. You know, going inductively to the facts one by one and then trying to generalize over them, that is inductively inadequate because it completely overlooks a whole segment of the world, world religions. But just think about Christianity. Overlooks an entire segment of the Christian or professedly Christian world that holds that virtue is self-sacrifice, not pleasure, not utility. Think in the Roman Catholic sphere, you have the monks who, far from pursuing pleasure, actually pursue asceticism. They beat their bodies, they don't get a lot of sleep, they work hard, they deny themselves sex, they don't believe in pursuing good, rich foods or being wealthy or whatever. They don't seek pleasure. And it certainly is not convenient to be a monk. And then that's just taking one example from one side of the Christian or professedly Christian world. Look in the Protestant world. We have people who maintain we ought to live for others, we ought to be altruistic, we ought to prefer others to ourselves, sacrifice our good and pleasure and happiness for that of others, right? We have Protestants who preach that you ought to go out on the mission field, even be willing to give up your life for Christ and so forth. I'm not asking Hume, on his terms, to agree that the monks are right or that the Christian or the Protestants who are calling for self-sacrifice are right. But the point is, if he's doing a descriptive ethic, he's got to take account of that, and he hasn't. Hume, I think, can be faulted on his own terms then. What we'll find is that Hume is not really doing a descriptive ethic. He's doing what? He's imposing his own personal prejudices. He has his own preconceived ideas of what ethics is like or should be like, and then he imposes that on the evidence. Kind of like old Procrustes. Remember the story of Procrustes in the ancient world, the innkeeper who had a bed? And all of his guests were going to fit his bed. If they were too short, he'd put them on the rack and stretch them to fit it. And if they were too long, he'd cut off body parts, making it, you know, convenient for them to be on the bed too. And Hume has just been a Procrustean here. He has not actually described ethics. He has told us his own prejudices about ethics. Now, what would Hume say to this? Well, Hume might come back and respond in this way. He'd say, well, it doesn't appear that the monk is pursuing pleasure. I mean, here he's denying his body. He doesn't eat a lot. He doesn't have money or sex or, you know, whatever it may be. It doesn't look like he's pursuing pleasure, but he really is, because that's his view of pleasure. That's what makes him happy. We run into this all the time when we discuss hedonistic ethics. Of course, Hume's not trying to be a hedonist. He's really just trying to be descriptive. But the same problem arises. Is it true that all men seek pleasure? Well, it doesn't appear so. And when it doesn't appear so, then what do? You do a little verbal adjustment so that whatever men seek is what you call pleasure. This is a clever line of debate, isn't it? what you do is you start out with what appears to be a substantive claim about men. They are seeking pleasure. You know, that seems to be saying something significant. But then when counter evidence to your claim is brought up, what do? You redefine the term so that you're automatically right. To say all men seek pleasure, when what you mean by pleasure is whatever a man seeks, has just reduced your thesis to a trivial tautology. That's saying all men seek what all men seek. Because what they seek is what you'll call their pleasure. So I realize that Hume and the followers of Hume think they have a way around my counter evidence, but what they end up doing is betraying the fact that they're not doing description of the world at all. They're just giving arbitrary definitions and then declaring themselves correct. Or you can look at this criticism another way. If Hume comes back and he says, well, it doesn't look like the monk is seeking pleasure, but he really is, what has happened to Hume's empiricism? Is that taking the observational approach? It may look like he's not seeking pleasure, but he really is. See, Hume is just as much committed to a certain presupposition about mankind, about the world, so forth, as the people that he detests. In a few moments, we'll see, he wants to consign all metaphysics to the flames. He's hostile against religion and so forth. These people are not good empiricists. You know, they have their abstruse speculations. Hey, guess what? As the Apostle Paul would tell us, it turns out that all men, even pagans, don't even live up to their own prescriptions. It's not just that they don't live up to what God tells them to do, they don't even live up to what they claim they're supposed to do. And Hume here is abandoning a descriptive, observational, or empirical perspective when he says, well, don't trust what it looks like. Trust my theory to explain what people are really doing. All right, let's go on in our summary of Hume's own views. I do hope that you'll be able to reproduce this criticism because, not patting myself on the back, but I think philosophically I just devastated Hume so much for his empirical neutrality and so forth. It just doesn't exist. Hume says that moral virtue over against other kinds of virtue, there are other kinds of desire and other kinds of utility than moral desires and moral utilities. In particular, he thinks moral virtue takes consideration of a person's motive or character, and secondly, amounts to disinterested approbation of things. Disinterested approbation. When people think that they're being moral, that is, again, describing the way morality works or moral discourse works, moral consideration of pleasure is disinterested pleasure. This is something that isn't just selfish or in my good. It's what is good or pleasurable or brings happiness to anybody or to everybody. Hume then tells us that the ultimate basis of moral judgment, as we talk about disinterested approbation, what's pleasurable for anybody and or everybody, the ultimate basis of moral judgment must be, and I quote him, some internal sense or feeling which nature has made universal in the whole species. Let me say that again. The ultimate basis of moral judgment must be, quote, some internal sense or feeling, some sentiment, which nature has made universal in the whole species. Does that sound like Hume talking? Could he really speak of a sentiment, quote, which nature has made universal in the whole species? Universal? Excuse me, David, have you forgotten what you've taught us already? There's no basis for universal judgments in Hume's skeptical approach to philosophy. And what does this mean, nature has made it universal? Well, let's give him a buy on this one. Let's be easy on him and just say he was speaking in a literary way. Don't try to make him out, be committed to some view of nature. Okay, well, I'll grant that he has the right to talk that way, but what was he talking about then? I mean, how would he recast this claim and get rid of this reference to nature? What is it that makes things universal throughout the species? Throughout the species? Isn't the species just my own imagination generalizing and filling in the gaps between particulars? Isn't that what he's taught us about universals? And once again we find, we're almost done with his ethic, by the way, but I think you see, Hume simply cannot carry out his program. He cannot discuss ethics and be true to his own philosophy. Even a mitigated, descriptive ethic becomes impossible for Hume to pursue. Well, then, what is the sentiment which nature has made universal in the whole species? Hume claimed it was benevolence. Benevolence. Benevolence leads to disinterested approbation of conduct that we believe is useful to mankind in general. When we look at things from a moral point of view and what it is that is desirable or useful, we'll find that the universal sentiment of mankind is a benevolence. We will approbate, we will approve of in a disinterested way that conduct that we think is useful to mankind in general. Now, we may be wrong about that, but what we consider virtue, what we're going to approve of, is what we consider useful to mankind in general. Now, the advantage, or at least the apparent advantage of this, is that it allows for us to resolve our ethical disagreements empirically. Right? Because when we're talking about ethics, what we're talking about is what will prove useful to mankind in general. We're looking at the utility for the utility, what is useful for the whole human race. To live a certain way, let's say, not by murdering each other. To avoid murder is more useful to the whole human race than to allow everybody to murder anybody they want. And so we ethically approbate that. We disinterestedly approbate or approve of the notion that men ought not to murder. That is an expression of our benevolence toward all men. We don't believe in murder. Now, what if someone comes along and says, well, I'm not so sure about that. I have a different understanding of what is going to be useful to the whole of mankind, and I think murder would be the most useful thing. See, Hume now, what he thinks he has gained is, well, now we can talk about who's right, who's wrong as a matter of fact. What really is the most useful? We can get down to, if you will, an observation. So again, Hume doesn't think that ethical discourse and disagreement has to come back to the abstruse speculations of the metaphysicians and certainly the superstitious ideas of the religionists of his day. Ethics can now be discussed in an entirely empirical fashion. Well, but I've got a bad piece of news for Hume. It may look like that he has made ethics now rationally discussable and resolvable in an empirical fashion, but has he really? Again, I'm not going to just put my view as a Christian up against his. I'm just going to stand on his ground and ask about his own view. According to him, benevolence, that sentiment of benevolence, leads us to, in a disinterested way, approve of that conduct that is useful to mankind in general. And if someone disagrees with us, then we can try to resolve that disagreement empirically. But the problem is, on Hume's view, to know what is the conduct to be approved, you need to know what is useful to mankind in general. Well, but how can I know what is useful to mankind in general? In general? Well, I don't know every individual that's ever lived or ever will live or even is now presently living. So let's make it easier on Hume. Let's just talk about people that are now alive, okay? But then he did say mankind in general. But how can I know what is useful to everybody now alive in general unless I know everybody that's now alive? There's an immediate answer that comes to your mind, but of course, the minute you start doing this, I'll give you the answer in a second, you are violating Hume's approach to philosophy. Most people would say, well, of course, you don't have to know everybody that's now alive because you can take, if you will, representative samplings, right? We see a few instances here and a few instances there, and we can generalize to what is true for all mankind. What does that assume? That assumes continuity of human nature. It assumes continuity in the natural world. It assumes that what I know in a few cases can be generalized to all cases. But of all people, David Hume would be the last person to take that approach. What is it that provides for our generalizations, like when we're doing causal analysis? Imagination does that, right? Instinct and habit. So it turns out that I can't really resolve differences with another person on the Humean approach. I can't do it empirically. The fact is, nobody can know all the consequences of a proposed line of behavior or particular kind of conduct. No one can know all of the consequences, much less the future consequences that are remote to us. Much less could anyone compute all of the consequences and remotely future consequences for mankind as a whole. And so I would maintain that Hume's empirical ethic simply comes to grief over and over and over again philosophically. It is not descriptively adequate. He makes reference to things that his philosophy doesn't allow him to make reference to, nature, universal sentiment, species, and so forth. And in the end, he thinks that you've got an empirical way to resolve differences, but that's only true if you'd be able to do what his philosophy says you can't do, and that's compute for the whole of mankind all the consequences of a particular line of conduct. So let's move on to something else in his philosophy, the last thing I want to talk about, and that is Hume's philosophical skepticism. Hume's philosophical skepticism. By this point in our lectures, it should be obvious to you that Hume, wanting to be the most consistent of all empiricists, wanting to outdo Locke, outdo Berkeley in following his empirical approach, has taken empiricism to what conclusion? Skepticism. You can't really know anything. But Hume's position leads to an even more negative or skeptical outcome than Hume himself seemed to have realized or been willing to admit. Hume talks about there being no basis in the world or in impressions from the world for continuing identity over particular moments or anything that unites particular events into a causal sequence. Remember? He says the self provides that. The self imagines. The self has its psychological expectations or habits. Well, I want to be more skeptical than even Hume was, because in making reference to the self constructing objects by imagination, filling in the gaps between the particulars, we have to ask, is the self a construct? Is the self a construct? Well, you can go two ways on that. You can say yes or no, right? Let's say the self is a construct. Well, then you have to say a construct of what? What constructs the self, if it itself is a construct? It's the self that allows us to construct unities between the particular impressions that we have, so that we have identity of some object over time, or we have a causal sequence among the events that we perceive. But what is this thing that's constructing that unity, imagining that causal sequence, having that habit to put A, B, and C together in that same sequence? In order to imagine the unity, identity, continuity, or causality out in the world, the thing that's imagining it cannot be something imagined, can it? Let me say that again. In order to imagine a unity, identity, continuity, or causality out in the world, the thing, whatever it is that's doing the imagining, cannot itself be imagined. If the self were only a flickering succession of loose and separate ideas, as Hume wanted to assert, then the self could never know the fragmentary world of discrete impressions as a world that has continuing objects with identity and events that show causal relationships to each other. That is, a fragmentary self, a bundle of perceptions, cannot even know itself as a bundle of perceptions, can it? And so Hume, you see, has been making reference to something for which his philosophy could give him no warrant. The idea of an enduring self that imagines how all the particular impressions get united into objects and into causal sequences. Well, let's talk about this causal principle that Hume was so skeptical of. Hume did what is basically a good job in showing that if somebody claims you can only know what you observe, if you can only know your impressions, and we don't ever have an impression of a necessary connection between one event and another, then we never know causation. There is no basis for causal analysis. That's just imaginary. That is just, if you will, the habit of my mind. But it's a habit, it's psychological, it's not rational. But I want you to notice that Hume's own argument, which aims to show that inductive inference is not rationally justified, Hume's own argument to the effect that you can't rely on inductive reasoning, causal reasoning, itself makes use of inductive inference. Hume's own argument against induction is itself resting on induction. And how is that? Because Hume has drawn some inductive generalizations about the working of the human mind, hasn't he? Hume tells us that what happens is we experience certain events in succession. As I said yesterday, we experience this event, the man with the cue stick, you know, has this event of thrusting it forward. Then we have this event that we perceive, the white ball moving across the table. Then we have this event that we see, the white ball stopping. And then this event, the black ball starting and going across the table and so forth. And what Hume says is that we see these things in succession, and seeing them in succession, we create a lively anticipation of that same succession next time. Well, is that true? Let's say, I'm going to be easy on him here. Let's just grant that the first time I see this, it does create in me an expectation that it'll happen again in that way. That succession will be the way things happen in the future. What Hume is saying is, I have an experience of succession, and that experience of succession creates a lively anticipation of it taking place again. Now, what's he resting on, though, when he uses this as his analysis of causation? He's assuming that the way things have happened in the past, I see succession, I anticipate succession, will be the way things happen in the future. I will now, in the future, see succession and anticipate succession. Hume, in his explanation of our inductive reasoning, himself has assumed an inductive or causal connection between things. He has drawn generalizations about human nature and the working of the mind, if you will. Hume sees a few workings of the mind. Now, we've already shown that he can't talk about the mind or the self, but he shows a few workings of the mind, and he generalizes that this is the way the mind works. Well, that's nothing less than inductive reasoning. Hume, of course, veiled that from himself. He exempted himself from his own critique. But you see, his own critique destroys his critique. Hume's critique of inductive inference destroys his critique of inductive inference, because he's got to use inductive inference to make good on what he is explaining. Anyway, Hume realized that his empiricism had taken him to skeptical conclusions. What Dr. Bahnsen has just added is that he should have been even more skeptical than he was. He kind of gave himself an easier ride than he deserved. But nevertheless, Hume would admit, and I would make it worse, that his philosophy leads to skepticism. And that seems to have bewildered him at times. He writes that it would fill him with melancholy and despondency as he reflected on it. Remember, Hume's living in the age of reason, right? Man's autonomous use of his mind is supposed to, show that he has a right to be confident that he can figure things out, he can know the world, he can solve his problems. In the age of reason, Hume, trying to be the best empiricist of all, ends up in skepticism. Where we thought there would be rational principles in the universe that provide a basis for intelligent choices and enlightened conduct, Hume took an experiential approach to life, to philosophy, and he said there are no such rational principles to be discovered. When Hume analyzed reason, then, he only found imagination, the self filling in the gaps between particular impressions. He only found, if you will, a private, subjective, psychological principle that pretends that there's an objective world of objects rationally and causally connected out there. But of course, if everything then reduces down to my psychological states and the imagination of my mind, what happens to the grandiose claims of the age of reason? Yeah, that did seem to make him gloomy. And Hume admitted he couldn't live this way, that he couldn't live with the consequences of his philosophy. And so he says at one point that when he starts reflecting on these things and they start making him all confused and upset and it seems like he couldn't know anything at all, what he'd do is he'd put his philosophy aside and go play backgammon with his friends. It's kind of like when you can't work out the intellectual problems, then just forget the intellectual problems and just go live your life anyway. Ignore them. Sweep them under the carpet. Now, in observing this about Hume, what I'm saying is that Hume, in a sense, was sympathetic to what we will today call pragmatism. Hume's empiricism, which led to skeptical conclusions, in a sense, opened him up to a kind of pragmatic approach to life and philosophy. Hume's pragmatism, if we can put it that way, is sometimes called mitigated skepticism. Mitigated skepticism. A skepticism that is pulled back from all of its vicious or ugly or unhappy consequences. What Hume seems to have discovered, to listen to his disciples who don't want to make his skepticism out to be destructive, is that a critical approach to life doesn't destroy our beliefs or make us unable to operate in the world. We will still go on living as if there is causation, as if we could draw inductive inferences, as if it were rationally justified to live this way and to think this way. We will go on living as if there is an external world where there are enduring objects, that there is an enduring self called me that experiences that world and so forth. Total skepticism, totally worked out, lived up to skepticism is impossible. You can't live up to it because you got to live your life in the world. We find in ourselves, therefore, according to Hume's disciples, that just like other animals, we have instincts. We have attitudes and behavior patterns. Just like animals act instinctively, we do. And instinctively, we think of the world in terms of enduring objects. We think of causation taking place between events in the world and so forth. And in particular, we find that as advanced animals, we have an instinct for experimental reasoning and to believe what our senses tell us rather than what imagination tells us. That is, it comes instinctively to this animal we call man to rest in the judgment of his senses, his observations, and to engage in experimental reasoning to make sure that he's observed the world and interpreted it properly. Now, we might, standing on the sideline listening to this, want to ask, how does man have such instincts to behave that way in the world? And the answer that is given today by the sophisticated pragmatist and followers of the mitigated skepticism of Hume is to say that's what has happened through the evolutionary process. The evolutionary process has instilled in us the instinct to trust our senses and to engage in experimental reasoning. Well, I'm pretty critical of that claim. When you speak of the evolutionary process, of course, we don't want to be talking about the winds of change and just reify something. Is there an evolutionary process if all we know are our discrete impressions? And, of course, I also think that there's a great deal to be said from an empirical scientific sense against this notion of the evolutionary process. But, to add a third criticism, even if I believed in the evolutionary process, I don't see how, you know, the protoplasm or the muck that is man's original soup can develop into something that has an instinct for thinking experimentally. I mean, I'm not sure that it makes a whole lot of sense to say that matter gave rise to something which is mental and experimental. Well, but you do need to know what people do with this approach to philosophy. So the mitigated skepticism of Hume becomes a kind of pragmatic outlook that, well, we still live our lives, and instinctively we will act this way. And when we instinctively act this way, we think in terms of causal principles and experimental reasoning and so forth. When we do that, we get by better in this world than if we don't. And there isn't any amount of philosophical reasoning that can destroy our instinctive ways of behaving. So, you know, you guys can come along and throw all of your rational problems at us, and you know what the pragmatist ultimately does? I'm overdrawing this, but to make the point. The pragmatist just laughs in your face and says, yes, but I can still balance my checkbook. I can still drive my car. I can still cure polio. On and on. And so I don't care that there are theoretical problems with what I say about the world. All I know is that I'm getting by all right. You know, I get melancholy about how I can get certainty about things. Hey, I can still go out and play backgammon with my friends, right? In fact, pragmatists will tell you absolute rational certainty is simply unattainable. Absolute rational certainty is unattainable, unless you're talking about pure mathematics. But then if you're talking about pure mathematics, you're not talking about the world. That gives you no information. That's just a way of relating your verbal tokens, the definition of 2 and 3 and 5 and so forth. So the pragmatist says, yeah, you've shown that I can't give you absolute rational certainty. But you know what? You don't need absolute rational certainty. And this, I find, as a Christian, rather humorous. It comes down to this. Whatever I'm not able to provide can't be important. You know, I start out doing philosophy, trying to come up with answers to explain what reality is, how we know what we know, and so forth, even to come up with a viable ethic. And if I fail to do it, that is, if there are problems, then the problem's not with me, it's with you expecting me to be able to give you a philosophy that has no problems. Isn't that clever? It's kind of like this. You know, you're in a history class, and you take your final exam, and you write your exam, and the professor shows, well, boy, I mean, you've got a lot of gaps here in your knowledge, and you've contradicted yourself, and you've said things for which there's no evidence at all, you've been imaginary and so forth. You've got all these defects, and what you say to the professor who's going to give you a D on this exam because of all these defects, you say, oh no, wait a minute, you're grading me by the wrong standard. You're expecting things that history students shouldn't have to come up with anyway. This is essentially what Hume and his disciples do when they run to mitigated skepticism and say, hey, we can still live our lives. If you're looking for absolute certainty, you're looking for the wrong thing. In fact, they believe that those who offer a philosophy of absolute certainty that tries to not have these defects and so forth are pretentious metaphysicians and theologians. They are trying to provide or claiming to provide what is impossible to provide. And so David Hume proposed that we, and I quote, or that he would, anybody who wants to be rational would, run over libraries and take in hand any volume of divinity or school metaphysics and ask, does it contain any abstract reasoning concerning quantity or number? No. Does it contain any experimental reasoning concerning matter of fact and existence? No. Commit it then to the flames, for it can contain nothing but sophistry and illusion. Commit it to the flames. Get rid of these metaphysicians, these people who try to talk about the nature of reality. Get rid of these theologians. It's nothing but sophistry and illusion. To put it very simply, the Humean skeptic is skeptical of abstract reasoning. but he has no problem. He's quite reconciled to concrete experience. And so this will be the spirit of pragmatism, which we're going to come to in our next course in the history sequence. But the pragmatist says, who cares about abstract reasoning? Who cares about theory? The only thing that counts is that we're getting by all right in our concrete experience. The criterion of what we ought to follow and accept is successful action in this world, experience in this world, not logic or epistemic certainty. The Humean skeptic would say, I can't justify the idea of regularity, but my experience shows that if I live in this world as though that regularity is there, I'm more successful. I can form generalizations, I can make plans, I can be successful in solving my problems. What more should anybody want? It's unreasonable to seek more than that. And so Hume once wrote, be a philosopher, but amidst all your philosophy, be still a man. This is so much the spirit of our age that it's hard for me to get people to stop and say, listen to what you're being told. I wrote an article on this, maybe you'd like to look at it sometime, entitled Pragmatism, Prejudice, and Presuppositionalism. You'll find that in the book Foundations of Christian Scholarship, and you'll get a somewhat detailed refutation of the pragmatic approach in which I show the pragmatists, and even to make their claims about success, have still got to rest upon more traditional philosophical approaches. Since time is short, I'll hope you'll go look at that article for details. But let me just give you one real quick illustration of this. The pragmatist says, all right, I can't give you a theory that doesn't have holes in it, but I don't need a theory because I'm a concrete man living in the midst of a concrete world of experience, and I've got a lot of success there. Success at what? Seems like an easy question, right? What do you mean you're being successful? You're getting by in your environment. Well, but you see, in order to be a pragmatist, you need to know what the proper goal of human life is. What are we supposed to be successful at, after all? And to answer that question, you have to fall back on what? Traditional philosophy. Moreover, in order to claim that you're being successful, you have to be able to make statements about what is true in your experience. But to make statements about what is true in your experience means that you're resting, again, on traditional philosophy and the ways that philosophers have spoken traditionally. And then finally, if someone says, I'm being successful, and then I counterclaim and I say, well, not really, you're being short-sighted. Let's say a person's living a life of materialistic pleasure, but he's getting by all right and so forth. His immediate problems seem to be solved. He's happy. And I come along, you know, being one of these abstruse theologians, and I say, yes, but eat, drink, and be merry, but tomorrow we die. And in the long run, you will not be successful because your life is more than just what you see right now. There will be a life that extends into eternity. And your momentary getting by successfully solving your problems is going to lead to the worst of all failures, where you have the discomfort of hell forever. Now, I know that that's, you know, Sunday school superstitious kind of talk that's going to be made fun of. But as a test of the pragmatist approach, I think it's legitimate, hypothetically, and say, now, wait a minute. You need to know, don't you, that there is no God, there is no afterlife, there is no everlasting damnation. You need to know that before you can really say with assurance that you're being successful. Because if you're being successful is only momentary and it brings an eternity of unsuccessful living, if we can put it euphemistically, then you haven't been pragmatic at all, have you? See, the pragmatist can't claim to be pragmatic, useful, unless he really knows the nature of reality, human life, and how we can say that things are true or false and so forth. So this mitigative skepticism of Hume that comes down to the pragmatic, concrete approach that says, I can live in this world, I don't need certainty, I think is just a ruse. It's just somebody disguising from himself the failure of his own philosophy and way of thinking. Anyway, the Humeans would say the skepticism shouldn't be taken as our final position. We would mitigate our skepticism and simply take it as a habit of mind. What we are endorsing is a skeptical habit of mind, not an ultimate conclusion, because it's not important whether you can have certainty or not, but what you should have is a skeptical frame of mind. Because skepticism will purge your mind of your delusions. It will reorient your approach to intellect away from the vain pursuit of certainty and will make you more a man of action. It will free you from the metaphysical nonsense of the theologians and others and set you out into the world to live your life skeptically, cautiously, but successfully. Now, a few moments ago, I told you that according to Hume, the reason why men trust their senses and the reason why they believe there are causal principles or connections in the world is because of instinct, right? And then today that would be explained by the evolutionary process. Man as an animal just has an instinct. He's found that he's more successful, survival of the species, right? You're more successful as the human species if you rest in your sense impressions, not in your vain speculations. And you're more successful if you expect that there are causal relationships out in the world. That's an instinct that has been built up in us. Well, my final criticism of Hume and his followers is, you know what, there's another instinct we find in men. And that's an instinct to say that things are meaningful. There's an instinct to understand the world. Or if you will, there's a passion for faith and confidence that I know who I am, that my life is significant and meaningful, that there is dignity to the human species, that this world is understandable and not some kind of big mystery. Now, what does Hume do with that instinct? I mean, you can't deny. I mean, when Hume and his followers criticize all these abstruse metaphysicians, they can't then deny that no one has ever instinctively pursued metaphysical answers. Now, even if you believe in the theory of evolution, the point is, if you think it's okay to follow your mitigated skepticism because that's just an instinct of the mind, then what do you do with the instinct for metaphysics, to understand reality, to know about God and the meaning of human life and so forth? And the only thing Hume and his disciples would say is that that instinct should be denied and the other instinct retained. Doesn't that seem a little arbitrary to you? If your whole answer is to make reference to man's instincts as an animal? For Hume, the urge to find metaphysical answers cannot be satisfied. Okay? So he says, follow your instinct that says rest in your observations and your experimental reasoning. That instinct you should follow. But deny that instinct that makes you want metaphysical answers. What's the nature of reality? Does God exist? Is there a self? And so forth. And then we have a right to say, well, but Mr. Hume, why should I accept one of those instincts and deny the other instinct? And you know what his answer has to be, which betrays his mitigated skepticism, which betrays his budding pragmatism? The only answer Hume would be able to give us for why we should follow one instinct but deny the other is because, he'd say, the instinct for metaphysical answers can't be satisfied. This universe is not the sort of thing where that kind of account can be given. Listen to me again. He'd have to say, reality is not the sort of thing that will allow you to have certainty. So follow the pragmatic instincts to trust your senses, do experimental reasoning. Deny the instinct that says, I want metaphysical security, I want certainty, I want to know the nature of reality. And I say, okay, why one and not the other? And what answer will he give? Because reality will not satisfy your desire for certainty. It's not that kind of thing. Well, I wish you all were jumping up and down in anger and indignation. Because isn't David Hume the one who tells us we can't know anything metaphysically? And yet he has his own metaphysical conviction that enables him to endorse a mitigated skepticism and to throw metaphysics out. Let me say that again. He has his own metaphysical conviction. Reality is not the sort of thing that you can understand with certainty. It will not satisfy your instinctive urge for metaphysical answers. He has his own metaphysical conviction by which he wants to throw out all metaphysics. Sorry if I'm getting too animated and angry, but you see, this is the heart of what all unbelievers want to do when they argue against the Christian faith. They'll say things like this: nobody can know anything for sure, but we're sure that you're wrong. No one can know anything about metaphysics, but of course I'm resting on some metaphysical conviction when I'm throwing out all metaphysics. And that's the final bottom line critique, internal critique of David Hume. David Hume was not nearly skeptical enough, and the attempt to mitigate his skepticism created as many problems as his skeptical philosophy itself did. All right, we're going to take a brief break, and when we come back, we're going to look then more broadly at the Enlightenment, the age in which Hume was living.